Well, if you turn in your Bible to Mark 11, we'll continue our study of Mark's Gospel. The passage we're going to look at today covers verses 12 through 21. It's a passage that I think bears some importance in our understanding of the nation Israel, its history, and also shows the value God places on the worship that his people would give to him. The passage really has two matters within it, the cursing of the fig tree and the temple cleansing. And I think that these two passages should be studied together because they really are linked together in what they teach us. So let me read the passage to begin with. It's a somewhat complicated passage, and because of that, I want to make some observations that I think will be helpful to us. So beginning in chapter 11, verse 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations?' But you have made it a den of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him, for they feared him because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered." And we'll stop there and pick it up next week, going on from that point. Here's something that I'd like to point out to you that I find is helpful. I've mentioned before that we find Mark to be the gospel that gives us the most clear chronology of events. And when we look at the passage last week, the triumphal entry, the first 11 verses, our understanding and correct understanding is that that was Sunday. The triumphal entry occurred on a Sunday. We call it Palms Sunday. Now, if you look at verse 12, notice how it begins, "On the following day." So there we know that now we're moving in this most important Passion Week to another day, to Monday. So what we read here in verses 12, actually through 19, are the events that occurred on Monday where he curses the fig tree and cleanses the temple. If you look at verse 20, it says, "As they passed by in the morning." Well, now we know that we're moving to Tuesday. And Tuesday is a very busy day. In fact, everything that you find from this point on in chapter 11 and chapter 12 and chapter 13, all of that happens on Tuesday, a very event-filled day and a day of conflict with religious leaders that occurred. And all the way through Mark, if you look for it, there's these clues you can tell what day these things are occurring on, and those are some of the clues right there. And as we go along, I'll point those out. But I think as you go through those chapters all the way to the end, you can pick up those clues as to what day of the week these things are occurring on. Now, what we have here in this cursing of the fig tree, it can be considered a parable. It's an acted out parable. I think that's the best way to look at this particular event here. Jesus loved to teach in parables, and he took events from life and presented them, and there was a spiritual truth illustrated in the parable. In this case, he actually acts it out. Because what we want to see here is that this fruitless fig tree symbolizes the fruitlessness of the nation Israel Jesus finds when entering Jerusalem. The nation is ripe for judgment, evidenced by the improper use of the temple, which is a place of worship, not a place for selfish business interests. And the growing confrontation that results from this with the religious leaders who represent the people is going to lead to his execution by crucifixion. Would you turn for a moment to Luke 19? Here's something I'd like to just include in our study today. In Luke 19, there are words that Jesus spoke on this occasion that nobody else includes. And I think they're very significant. I'm getting really slow getting to these places, it seems like. Luke 19, look at verse 41. And if you look at the context here, for instance, in this Bible, it mentions that Luke 19, verse 28, is the triumphal entry. He spoke these words right after the triumphal entry had occurred. Verse 41 says, "And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, 'Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace. But now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you because you did not know the time of your visitation.'" And what is being spoken of in this particular passage here is the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD. At that time, the temple was destroyed, the city burned, the people exiled. And actually, Israel has been without a homeland until in our own days. In 1948, they once again became a sovereign nation with a homeland. Now, let me just make some observations about what we're looking at here today that I think might be helpful. Concerning the cleansing of the temple, each gospel has a temple cleansing in it. But what we call the synoptics, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and we speak of those three gospels as the synoptic gospels, comes from a Greek word that means to see together, because they are more closely related in how they present the ministry of Jesus. Those three gospels all speak of a temple cleansing that occurs at the end of Jesus' ministry, in this Passion Week. John, however, is different. John presents a temple cleansing not at the end of Jesus' ministry, but at the beginning of his ministry. That's why we find it in John chapter 2. And just so we're clear on this, there were two temple cleansings. John speaks of one that occurred early in Jesus' ministry. The other three speak of the one that occurred at the end of his ministry. And there are differences in those passages. For instance, in John's passage, Jesus says, "Do not make my Father's house a place of trade or a place of merchandise." When you come to the cleansing during Passion Week, his language is even stronger. He says, "You have made my Father's house a den of thieves." So just to be clear, there some people have thought somehow the Gospels are mixed up here on this. No, there were two different temple cleansings. Another thing I thought I would just kind of mention to you, Matthew and Mark are the only Gospels that record this cursing of the fig tree. Luke and John don't have it. Luke does have a parable of the fig tree. You'll find it in Luke chapter 13, but it's something different. It's related to this, but it's something altogether different. Only Matthew and Mark record the cursing of the fig tree, and we could ask the question, do they conflict? And the answer is no, they do not conflict, but there's some things that can be confusing about it. Because, well, let's turn, if you would, to Matthew 21. And as you read in Matthew 21, you read about the triumphal entry. And it might seem as if the way it is presented here that the cleansing of the temple occurred on the same day as the triumphal entry. Because you can read that passage, it's in Matthew 21, and it's the first 10 verses, and then first 11 verses, I guess it is, and then verse 12, Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who sold and bought in the temple. So it almost reads as if the triumphal entry and the cleansing of the temple occur at the same on the same day. But Mark puts it differently because as we're seeing in this passage here in Mark 11, verse 12, on the following day, he cursed the fig tree and then entered into the temple and cleansed it. And here's what we need to understand about that. So we don't get confused and we begin to think there's some kind of contradiction in Scripture. Mark is the gospel that is the most chronological. You can go there to get your chronology figured out. Matthew tends to arrange material more thematically. He's not concerned with putting everything in a chronological order. And as you study Matthew's gospel, it becomes very clear that he arranges his material somewhat differently, and he's doing it because he is presenting it in a thematic fashion. We simply can't force modern ideas of necessary chronological order on some of these gospel documents. In fact, probably all ancient documents. It's just not their way. And so just keep that in mind, and if you see something that you think, I don't see how these fit together, well, just realize that Matthew, perhaps, if you're reading Matthew, he's not as concerned with the order as it is thematically ordering his material together. Now, here's something else that I might just mention. We're going to get into the text itself pretty quickly here, but it's interesting reading in some of my commentaries. There are commentators who, well, they almost write of Jesus as if he's displaying a bad temper here. He's having a temper tantrum and destroys this fig tree. It's not my commentators. They tell of others who've held that view. And some people have written, and it's almost as if they want to discount the whole passage because they just don't think that Jesus would have acted so badly. And people who would write something like that, you have to wonder, what's their view of the inspiration of Scripture? But I wanted to read this one to you, and this is from a very fine commentary by Walter Wessel is his name, where he quotes T.W. Manson. This is rather surprising that somebody would write this. But listen to what this man, T.W. Manson, said about this. This is the cursing of the fig tree. He says, it is a tale of miraculous power wasted in the service of ill temper for the supernatural energy employed to blast the unfortunate tree might have been more usefully expended in forcing a crop of figs out of season, and it's as it stands, it is simply incredible. I think it's simply incredible that anybody could write something like that, but obviously this man did. Of course, as an aside, I was thinking about this So I was preparing this. I sort of might identify with Jesus in this unfortunate criticism because, you know, I have a reputation for cutting down trees, cutting down church trees. I'm not sure I've ever been totally forgiven for the demise of the holly tree, although some of you helped me do that. So anyway, let's get into the text now. This is, first of all, the cursing of the fig tree. Back to verse 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And we might want to just note that. He was hungry. We see every once in a while these indications of the human nature of Jesus. We read, for example, not only was he hungry on this occasion, but he was really hungry when he was tempted by the devil and hadn't eaten for 40 days. We read about his account with the woman at the well. He was thirsty and he was tired. Or here in Mark 4, we read about the time that he was asleep in the boat. Remember that? And the storm arose. And of course, then he showed his great power when he calmed that storm. It's good to be reminded, I think, of who Jesus is. He is God and he is man. He is the God-man, having all the full attributes of divinity and all the full attributes of humanity by which he associates and understands us. He shares our humanity, except, of course, for that one most important matter. He had no sin nature and never sinned. But we can see his humanity here in that he was hungry. Going on in verse 13, seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. Now this matter of the fact there were no figs on the tree is quite interesting and somewhat complicated, it seems. Here's how I would best understand that as far as the things I've read in the books. And I always feel kind of unsure of myself speaking to some of you about agricultural matters because some of you know so much about it that I don't. And you probably know things about fig trees that I don't. But I did read here that fig trees have two seasons to them, at least the ones that they had in Israel here. There was a season for early figs, and those were small figs, and they would become ripe in May or June. But realize this time here is before that. It's at least a month before that because this is Passover season. We associate this around Easter, and it's probably very early April. Then also, there would be later figs, and those would be the large ones, and they would become ripe in August. So just a point of interest that fig trees bear twice, the smaller ones first and the larger ones later. But as I said, this is April. So it says it's not the season for figs. It's a little bit early for figs. However, now A.T. Roberts, and I'm quoting what he says about this, says, "But this precocious tree in a sheltered spot had put out leaves as a sign of fruit. It had promise without performance." And here's what Hendrickson says, and he very much agrees, basically, with that other quote. I'm quoting him now. "But Jesus notices that this particular tree, growing by the side of the road, and thus probably in a sheltered place, was something special. It had leaves, was most likely in full foliage, and could therefore be expected to have fruit. Yet it had nothing but leaves. It promised much, but provided nothing." And so both of these commentators are seeing this as a special tree in a special place, perhaps, that Jesus had some reason to think that though it's not the season yet, that it should have produced figs. And then Hendrickson says this, the pretentious but barren tree was a fit emblem of Israel. And there are other prophets that do speak of Israel not only as a vineyard, a favored designation for Israel, but sometimes as a fig tree. And the Jews were to be a special people bearing fruit unto God. If you want to turn to it or not, I'm going to read to you from Amos, the book of Amos, chapter 3. And here's what Amos says here. This is a significant statement made about Old Testament Israel. I'm going to begin with chapter 3, verse 1 of Amos. Hear this word the Lord has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the whole family that I brought up out of the land of Egypt. And then verse 2, here's what he says. You only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Now that's a significant statement that God says of Israel. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. And he's using the word known there in the sense of treated with favor or chosen or elected. We see it used that way sometimes in Scripture. And the truth of the matter is that Israel is a special nation that God chose to have covenant relationship with, and he had reason to think that there would bear fruit, the fruit of righteousness, the fruit of obedience unto him. And yet throughout their history, of course, we saw that lack of fruit and the disobedience of the nation. And here's another quote I want to give you. This is a significant quote from Hendrickson about this, and it leads into the next part now, the cursing of the fig tree. Listen to what he writes. The pretentious fig tree had its counterpart in the temple where on this very day, Monday, a lively business was being transacted so that sacrifices might be made, while at the same time the priests were plotting to put to death the very one apart from whom these offerings had no meaning whatever. Plenty of leaves, but no fruit. Bustling religious activity, but no sincerity and truth. Tremendous promise, but a very poor performance. In cursing the fig tree and in cleansing the temple, Jesus performed two symbolic and prophetic acts with one meaning. He was predicting the downfall of unfruitful Israel. Not that he was through with the Jews, but that in the place of Israel, an international and everlasting kingdom would be established, a nation bringing forth not just leaves, but fruits, and gathered from both Jews and Gentiles. And of course, Hendrickson is comparing them, speaking there them of the church as we know it today. So let's go to the other passage here, which is the cleansing of the temple. Verse 15 says, and they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple. I thought I'd just give you some sketchy information about the Jerusalem temple. Of course, the original temple was the one that had been built by Solomon. David's son Solomon was the great temple builder. And you can begin to read about that in 1 Kings chapter 6. And we read there that the construction of the original temple, it took 7 years to build, and it was completed in 961 B.C. It was destroyed almost 4 centuries later by the Babylonians when they destroyed the temple in 586 B.C. Then there was a second temple, and that came about because the Babylonians were overthrown by the Persians, and the Persian emperor Cyrus the Great permitted a rebuilding of a second temple, and that work began in 536 BC. There was a work stoppage. There was discouragement among the people. They had enemies, and they kind of gave up. But then through the prompting of two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, they resumed that building in 520 and completed that second temple in 515 or 516 B.C., which counts for a 70-year period of time that is prophesied. Now, this second temple, commonly called Zerubbabel's temple, because Zerubbabel played a major part in its building, was a smaller temple, not as impressive as the first. And then there was, maybe we could call it a third temple. Some people would say, well, it's an extension of the second temple, but there was another temple, or at least an elaboration of that temple, and that's the one. This is the one that we're speaking of here. Herod the Great actually played a major role of enlarging the temple, and he just loved to build things, and this the new temple, the temple that we're talking about in this passage here, that Jesus is going to cleanse, was very grand by all human standards. Once again, let me quote from Hendrickson's commentary, and this is what Josephus, the Jewish historian, wrote about the temple that stood in Jesus' day. The exterior of the building lacked nothing that could astonish either the soul or the eyes, for, being covered on every side with massive plates of gold, the sun had no sooner risen than it radiated so fiery a flash that those straining to look at it were forced to avert their eyes as from the solar rays. To approaching strangers, it appeared from a distance like a snow-clad mountain, the reason being that whatever was not overlaid by gold was purest white. And so this was a beautiful temple, at least by human standards, and it included something in it that was unique. It included what is called the Court of the Gentiles. It had numerous courts, but the largest court, the outer court, was the Court of the Gentiles, and Gentiles could go into this court. They couldn't go beyond it. Then there was the Court of the Women, then there was the Court of the Men, then there was the Holy Place, and then the Most Holy Place. And this Court of the Gentiles is significant here. We want to see in that God's grace, even to non-Jews, that there was a place that they too could go to learn of Yahweh, to learn of the God of Israel, and to worship Him. But this is where the abuse is occurring that Jesus is so offended by that He is going to cleanse it. Because the Court of the Gentiles has become a place of smelly animals, noisy people, and just crowds. All that would detract from the proper worship of God. So then we begin to read as to what He did to cleanse the place of these abuses. So, picking it up again here in verse 15, He entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. All this is going, this wouldn't occur in the Jewish courts, it's occurring in the Court of the Gentiles. And there are people there who are selling animals. And there's a need for this because people are coming. This is Passover season. They've got to bring their animal for sacrifice or else buy one there. Most of these people have come from a long ways away, too far to bring an animal. Some of them has come as far away as from Rome itself. So they came with their funds to buy a sacrificial animal, but what they found there then was animals, the price was inflated, they were being taken advantage of. Then it says He overturned the tables of the money changers. There was also a provision under the law that when you bought your animal, you couldn't just use any coins. You couldn't just use those coins that you used back in your home country. No, you had to trade those in for special coins, coins that had been one time minted in the ancient city of Tyre. They evidently minted the finest coins in the world. And so once again, before you could even buy the animal, you had to get the proper coins, of course, at an inflated price. So Jesus was offended by that and overturned their tables. And this says in verse 16, he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And this was because people were using the temple as a shortcut. If people wanted to get from the city to the Mount of Olives, why go all the way around the temple? Let's just walk right through it. Like maybe people walk through your backyard sometimes and people take shortcuts. Making the temple something for a purely secular use. These are the reasons that Jesus cleansed the temple, because these abuses that were going on, and it says in verse 17, he was teaching them and saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. And it's most significant that what Jesus said here and the quote that is he's quoting here, where is it from? Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 57. My eyes are kind of failing me to see it right now. But this is Isaiah 56, verse 7, a prophecy of God's use of the to make available for all the nations opportunities of worship. And this, of course, led then to an elevated opposition from these religious leaders. Here's some observations I think we might want to make concerning this. I think we ought to see from this, worship really is important to God. And worship, whether it's then or now, should be pure, should be true, should be correct according to the Scriptures. Jesus said we worship in spirit and truth. And I think if we take a lesson from this, we should make every effort when we come on the Lord's Day to be prepared and to cleanse ourselves and maybe even think the night before of the opportunity and what we're going to do on Sunday morning if we come to worship. And maybe particularly as we think of the Lord's Supper that we celebrate once a month, how important it is to come before Him with pure hearts and honest, prepared to worship. The other observation I would make here is how gracious God is. He's inviting the Gentiles to come to the temple. He's even set aside a special place for them. I mean, this is not just a place for them to congregate and pass the time of day. Obviously, it's a place for them to come and to learn, to worship, to give praise, to learn of this great God who is the God of Israel, but He's going to be the God of all the nations of the world. And we see even in this, I think, a peek into that future gospel. These apostles are going to take the gospel to all the nations of the world and what we know as the Great Commission. That's why this court existed. Just reading on then, verse 20, I'll finish this up. And as they passed by in the morning, so now here's that key, where this is Tuesday morning now, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots, and Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. And I agree with these expositors like Hendrickson and Wessel and others who have seen that these two events, it's like an acted out parable. Because it does seem that Israel as a covenant nation currently has been set aside by God. In fact, turn if you would, we're going to stop pretty soon, but just a couple more verses. If you'll turn back to Matthew 21. In Matthew 21, there's an important parable, and I won't read it to you now, but it begins in Matthew 21, verse 33, the parable of the tenants, where here Jesus compares Israel not to a fig tree, but to a vineyard. It's a favorite designation, comes from Isaiah chapter 5, where Israel was is like a vineyard that God planted and hoed and pruned, and he took care of and expected it to bring fruit. And yet you read in the parable here, the people who are tending the vineyard, when people are sent to them to receive the fruit, they kill them, they mistreat them like they did the prophets of Israel. And eventually they kill the son of the owner. And of course that's Jesus. And then we have this verse, verse 43. Therefore I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruits. And that has happened. Israel has been set aside, and God has now raised up a new Israel, or the Israel of God, as Galatians 6, verse 16, the church made up of Jews and Gentiles, and he's carrying out his kingdom building plan through the church today. But that's not the end of the story. God does have a future for ethnic Israel. It's clear he does. Turn to Romans chapter 11, and this will be our last passage for today. There's many different interpretations of what is written here in Romans 11, verse 26. I have my opinion on it. Others have their opinions as well. I guess we'll see how it works out. But it does make clear that God so gracious that he hasn't rejected ethnic Israel forever. Because we have these words in Romans 11, verse 26 from Paul, all Israel will be saved. All Israel will be saved. Now, as I say, there's different interpretations of how we should understand that. And in a good study Bible, and like the Reformation Study Bible, you can read there and get opinions on that. But I know God has a future plan for ethnic Israel. I think that's why they're back in the land today. I think that's why, since 1948, they have a homeland again. They have become a sovereign nation again. I don't think it's in order to establish a millennial kingdom there, although some would believe that, and there are arguments that might be developed. But I think that they're back there because God is going to fulfill his promise to them. And at some point in before the world, before the new heavens, new earth, he's going to convert Israel. There's going to be a great evangelistic thrust. We speak of the great awakening that occurred in the colonies in the 1740s. This will be a great awakening. And he's going to convert his covenant people someday. In the meantime, we are God's covenant people. He has made a covenant with the church, with the new covenant. And just as there was an expectation with the Old Testament covenant people, they would bear fruit for God. Oh yes, there's still an expectation that we as God's covenant people will bear fruit too. And he has given us his word and he's given us his spirit that we might bring forth that fruit that honors him and pleases him. Well, we'll stop there today, and next week we're not going to take so many verses, but we'll look at, we'll only go as far as down up to verse 27. So let's stop there for today.